Mid mornings with Lee Chambers.
Cambridge 105. I'm coming up now to an interview I did with Roger Lilly. He's a postcard collector. He's got a massive collection of postcards, principally from World War One and World War Two. He came into the studio about two or three weeks ago. I chatted to him then. So, Roger, thank you very much for coming into the Cambridge 105 studios. You collect postcards from the First World War or the Second World War as well?
I collect postcards in a quite broad way. I mean, I'm particularly interested in First World War postcards, but I've also got a collection trying to collect images of places in which family members lived, perhaps 100 years ago, also other interesting places. I mean, the thing about postcards is that, you know, the genres are very, very wide, and there's always, you know, lots of different interesting aspects to them.
And how many postcards do you think you have in total?
Probably, I don't know, several thousand now. I mean, I sometimes acquire them individually, but sometimes, if you're lucky, you can acquire them literally by the kilo.
Where do you keep them all?
Well, I used to keep them in boxes, but actually now I've particularly focused on the First World War. I mean, it's much more interesting to keep them in somewhere that's accessible, and also somewhere where you can actually view both sides of the postcard, you know, because often what's on the back is as interesting as what's on the front.
And how did you come to start collecting them? What drew you to postcards?
Well, it was probably about 3 or 4 years ago that I was looking for pictures basically to illustrate certain aspects of family history. And I was looking for postcards of places like Southend-on-Sea, where my father lived almost 100 years ago. And I was also looking for pictures of one or two more well-known family members. In particular, there was an Edwardian actress called Lily Brayton. And I discovered that you could actually find quite a lot of postcards of her available, you know, on sale online. So I started collecting those and realised, actually, there was a whole world of extraordinary postcards. And that was particularly when I discovered First World War postcards. I had no idea that there were so many designs and they were so beautiful and so elaborately put together, and particularly French postcards. I mean, you notice very quickly that there's, you know, the quality and the standards of art which the postcard designers were achieving were quite amazing. So I was fascinated by this, and particularly when I realised that you could actually get hold of actual correspondence between people, it sort of brings the postcards to life. I mean, a lot of people collect postcards simply for the images on the front, but actually, you know, if you turn the postcard over, you know, you can find, if you're lucky, not just one postcard, but a whole series of postcards which reflect the correspondence. And I was very lucky early on, quite by chance, because I hadn't been able to look at the back of the postcards. I managed to acquire a batch from France via eBay, which was basically the entire wartime correspondence of a couple. The wife at home looking after the children, managing the family smallholding, and her husband at the front. They wrote profusely to each other. This was not just one line, no, the weather's okay, how are you? Detailed descriptions, no, what was life was back home and what was life was like at the front. And, you know, through that, you know, the war actually sort of comes alive.
And why postcards? Why not letters? It's quite personal information that people are delivering to each other on the back of postcards. We possibly wouldn't put that personal information on a postcard today.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. I mean, I think at the time, generally, sending postcard was very cheap. It was also a novelty, you know, in the same way that, you know, a lot of social media is novel today. I mean, postcards had really only been around since the end of the 19th century. It was by far the cheapest and easiest way for people to keep in touch. Remember this in the days before telephones. If you just wanted to let someone know you were okay and you were still alive, you know, you send them a postcard, and people might be exchanging postcards, you know, every day or so. And it quickly became apparent to publishers that, you know, in order to boost sales, the more effort they put into designing attractive pictures, the more likely were to sell their brand of postcard. And at a time when, really, people might only have seen black and white newspaper images, a coloured postcard picture was something really quite exciting. there wasn't television, there weren't colour photographs. So the ability to buy a colour image, perhaps of your hometown and send it to someone else, or a colour image of a beautiful woman or a baby or something like that, I mean, it was something quite exciting to, I mean, it must have been quite exciting to receive that through the post.
So the images that the soldiers were sending and postcards from France or wherever they were back home during the First World War, was there a typical image? Were they morale-boosting sentiments on the front or were they general pictures?
There's a very wide variety. I mean, one of the most extraordinary things is the number of postcards that were sent showing the damage caused by war. And you can find these on both sides, soldiers sending home or just people sending between themselves images of, you know, utter destruction in some of the towns along the front. But then similarly, you would have very romantic images. Very typical would be a scene of a lady, presumably the wife, and then you can see above her, she's imagining her husband, boyfriend, at the front. It might be fighting, or it might be imagining him sitting down, smoking a cigarette or something like that. There were a lot of images gained at arousing patriotism, and these might involve children. You know, there are lots of postcards with children wearing military costume. I mean, the French government in particular were very, very concerned that having families broken up like this for what turned out to be years was going to have a really detrimental effect on morale. And it must have been the same fears must have been, you know, existed over here. And so using patriotic images on postcards, images which would help communicate affection to your loved one, were really important. Other postcards would actually have poems printed on them. There were lots of postcards had cartoons, gently poking fun at the military, and some of them are quite savage and very satirical. They're quite gruesome images, particularly if they were trying to raise feelings, anti-German feelings. So there was a big demand for high-quality photography, high-quality artists, and a lot of professional artists switched to designing postcards during the war, and there's some quite famous names. There was also a lot of competition among the postcard publishers, obviously, to get the highest possible quality of colour reproduction. So, yeah, I mean, the variety of postcards is quite amazing.
And, of course, we're talking in an era before telephones, certainly before mobile phones. And so these were the only means of communication between the soldiers at the front and their families. They were an absolute lifeline for both parties.
They're an absolute lifeline. And, again, what's striking is the variety in terms of the information that they contain. It seems apparent that the British soldiers weren't allowed to write very much. I mean, remember, all these postcards from the front had to go through military censors, and they weren't allowed to give away much about, you know, what was happening at the front. Some postcards even have the legend on the front which says where the place is. That's even been erased so that it's not possible for the person back home to associate the image on the front of the postcard with the location of the soldier. However, there are other opportunities when people could write a great deal and quite graphically. But I think certainly in many cases, soldiers were limited to what they would write. So quite often they just say, weather's okay, I'm in the pink, is a phrase that comes up a great deal. And you often have to read between the lines. On the other hand, I mean, there are some occasions when you get very graphic insights. We've got a postcard of a French woman writing to her husband who's reporting on the death of someone they know, a young man who was killed by a bullet while he was playing a game, jumping up and down in the trenches. And he was unlucky, he was jumping up and down and the sniper got him. And you have an image here of young men at the front, bored out of their minds, doing stupid things, basically, you know, to pass the time, and being shot in the process.
And presumably it was important for the men at the front to have somebody to write to. I mean, whether that was a lover or a parent or a sibling.
Oh, yeah, it was absolutely vital, to such an extent that actually there were government campaigns to recruit women to write to soldiers. And so some soldiers were getting letters or postcards from women that they hadn't ever actually met. Sometimes were were writing back, and at some stage actually really wanted to meet this woman. And you wonder.
Well, I hope you're going to tell me there are happy endings.
I just know that particularly in France, there was a national scheme to set up regular correspondence between soldiers and other people. And there may well have been some happy stories at the end of this. Yeah,
I'd like to think so. Yeah. But the postcards that tend to be hooked onto, I suppose, or focused on, are the dramatic ones that we hear about, of the last one sent before somebody goes over the top. But presumably most of the postcards between Britain and France were much more mundane than that.
Yeah, I mean, it would be extremely rare that you would know the circumstances, in which the postcard had actually been written. Mainly there was a traffic between a family and soldier at the front, but then also between civilians. And sometimes you get interesting references to what's going on in the war. I've got a couple of postcards between two women. One of them has lived on the Yorkshire coast, and they're exchanging notes. I think it was in 1915. The German fleet actually shelled some of the coastal towns like Whitby and Scarborough. And after events like that, local photographers would produce postcards. And this is one of the interesting things about postcards, is that quite often they were produced in very, very limited quantities. They might have shown something that happened locally, like in the case of the shelling of the Yorkshire towns. But also there were opportunities for people to make their own postcards. It was very common for people to have their photograph taken, let's say in uniform, or photograph taken with their platoon or their brass band, and then they would send that to family members. Sadly, in most cases, we have the postcards, but we have no idea of who is shown on the postcard unless someone wrote a note. But see, so people were sending, or were actually making and having printed their own personal postcards, as well as buying those which were sort of commercially produced and broadly available anywhere.
You're talking about a lot of information being conveyed on a postcard. Did they write in code or very small? How did they get all that information on the back of a postcard?
Some postcards are extremely difficult to read because obviously there were some people who perfected the art of writing incredibly small. On the whole, I think most people just scribbled just two or three sentences. Make sure their family members knew that they were still alive, they were thinking about them. For most of these soldiers, they did get home and they did see their family again.
How did they find their way to the right person, these postcards? This is what I've often known, because you have to sort of single down a regiment, a trench, an individual, and often they're in the middle of a conflict, perhaps in the middle of a field. How did they get there?
That's a good point. I think the military were extremely well organised. They had to be well organised because they knew that these postcards were extremely important for morale. So that as long as you put down the details of the unit, the regiment and the battalion, the postcards got through. All the armies had very, very highly organised systems. German army actually printed its own postcards, not picture postcards, which were distributed to soldiers. And there was a whole system within the military of making sure these were delivered and posted. And for soldiers, of course, the postage was usually free if the postcards were sent through the army franking service.
And presumably there's lots of anecdotal evidence of the morale-boosting effects of postcards on either side, on the people at home and on the soldiers.
I think we can assume they're morale-boosting. I mean, what was probably even more morale-boosting was to get a package, of chocolate and cigarettes. But the important thing about postcards, that they were cheap enough that people could keep sending them on a regular basis.
What's your favourite postcard of your entire collection?
There are some very witty, very funny ones. One of the first ones I found was a postcard divided up into about six little windows. It depicts a soldier. The French soldiers were known as poilus, which was a slang word for a plucked chicken. It referred to the fact that their heads, when they entered the army, were shaved, and it reminded people of the skin of a chicken. So there were lots of references in French postcards to the life of a poilu. And one of the funniest ones is cartoon images, and the soldier is writing back to his wife, trying to pretend that everything is okay and the food is great and nothing is too dangerous. But the images show these shells whizzing past him, all the explosions going on. Perhaps what they're trying to show is that life wasn't as dangerous at the front as someone at home might think. In fact, for many it was incredibly dangerous, but probably it was just dirty. There was so much ill health and disease. But on the whole, people didn't write about that. they try to cheer the person that they were writing to back home up.
And how does it feel to you when you hold these postcards now and you read these letters from people long gone, but messages sent from loved one to loved one?
They're an incredibly powerful way of personalising the whole experience of a terrible thing like the war, to actually hold the letters and the postcards which, you know, people would have handled. And you just have to put yourself in the shoes of, you know, perhaps someone at either end, either at the front or back home, receiving a postcard and knowing that the person who wrote it was still alive, they were still thinking about them. And I think that's why it's so much more interesting to collect the used postcards, the ones that have actually been sent, than the ones which, when you turn over, are just completely blank.
And for those soldiers that didn't return home, sometimes the postcards presumably were all the families had left of them, or that experience at the front.
I think that must be the case. Well, to some way, it seems, what's sad to me is that large numbers of these postcards now are coming up at auctions and for sale. The families who once received them are long gone, and they haven't been passed on, and they're ending up in the hands of collectors like myself. I mean, I feel privileged to have these postcards, but I'm not the person they were intended for originally. I mean, in the case of one of these sets of French postcards, we've actually been in touch with the village in France where this family lived, and been in touch with one of the archivists, who's really excited that we've actually discovered a set of postcards which describes the First World War experience of a family that lived in their village, and, you know, they weren't even aware of.
Because there's something very personal, isn't there, very touching about a person's handwriting, that if you know that person well, you can recognise their handwriting instantly, and then when they're not around anymore, that is all you have left. There's still something very poignant and powerful about that. Those families must have treasured those cards if their loved one didn't come home.
Yeah, and you can tell that from the fact that, you know, it was very traditional in Victorian, Edwardian, early 20th century for people to keep postcard albums, beautiful postcard albums, and perhaps the keeping of the album itself was triggered by the fact they were getting postcards from, you know, family members a long way away. Yeah, I mean, I think people did treasure these postcards. But also, I think the need for information, the need for images of the war, you know, the interest in the First World War, stimulated people just into collecting postcards. And you had newspapers like the Daily Mail producing very interesting, very graphic series of postcards, which they knew people were buying simply to collect, so that they actually had something that gave them images of what was going on in Europe that they could concentrate on. In the days before easy access to photographs on TV or the internet, I mean, the postcards were the way in which people could visually get to grips with what was going on.
Now, you see, I told you it was interesting, didn't I? Yes, that's Roger Lilly there, talking about his collection of postcards from the First World War and the Second World War. And the First World War postcards, a selection of them anyway, are on display at Rock Road Library. If you don't know where Rock Road is, it's off Blincoe Grove. It's kind of between Cherry Hinton Road and Hills Road. The library itself is wonderful, and there's an exhibition in the community room about how World War One affected the lives of the people who lived around the library, not just through enlisting and fighting, but just through everyday life. And there's two cases full of those wonderful postcards that Roger was talking about there. And you can see both sides. You can see the messages on the back and the beautiful pictures on the front.
Mid-mornings with Mandy Morton. Cambridge 105.
Now, the death of the actor Warren Mitchell was announced this weekend, and I was lucky enough to meet him when he came to the Cambridge Arts Theatre. We sat down to tea at the Garden House Hotel on a hot, sunny day and talked about the many faces of the man known to millions as the bigot Alf Garnett. Warren began by talking about his time back in the 1930s and his family roots in the East End of London. And I should actually warn you that the interview does contain some mild swearing.
We lived in Leighton, which was sort of the first step out of the East End. And I remember my father coming back, ashen face, saying, "We've gone off the gold standard," which I never understood. And I can remember the Abyssinian War. I can remember certainly the Civil War in Spain, pictures in the paper. I can remember one of a Republican soldier with two cigarettes in his mouth, desperate to have a cigarette. He had to have two at a time to make up for the fact that he hadn't had any. It was a strange time when Hitler was on the make, and being a Jewish family, my father was of course appalled, and we were shown pictures of this terrible Kristallnacht, which is the night when all the Jewish shops were, they smashed all the windows and they dragged Jews out and beat them. So I grew up in a very tumultuous time, the 30s. It was also, trade unions were then having to become militant. That's when the hunger marchers came from Jarrow and marched on London and said, we want jobs, we want to feed our families. It was a time of tumult and concern. As a child, you know, how much do you register? Not all that much. Selfish little bastards we were, you know, all children are.
You've spoken about your father. What about the women in your family, your mother and your grandmother? Mm.
My mother was an adoring, wonderful mother who took me to the theatre. We went to see a lot of variety shows. We never saw a straight play for a long time. We'd go to the Holborn Empire and see Max Miller, who I adored. And now, there's a funny thing. There is a funny thing, lady. Now, look at his eyes, lady. Mrs. Miller's oldest son. And we went to the Finsbury Park Empire and we went to the Palladium and saw the Crazy Gang every show in the leading up to the war. My mother encouraged me, was quite happy with the idea of me perhaps being a performer, because she caught me one day imitating my sister doing her elocution. Now, my friend Mrs. Gray, who lives over the way, had her first baby just 3 weeks today, and she asked a few friends and relations to view this wonderful baby as fond mothers do. The first was Miss Jones, an old spinster, and she gazed through her lorgnettes and exclaimed doubtfully. It was the piece that my sister was doing, and I started to imitate. My mother said, do you want to go to Gladys Gordon's Academy? And I did. I went to Gladys Gordon's Academy in Ho Street, Walthamstow, and did singing and dancing. And turned it in when I was 8, I think. I thought it was sissy, and I wanted to go to football Saturday afternoons anyway and see the Spurs, my team. And I didn't go near the theatre again until the war, I suppose, in the RAF on a troop ship coming back from Canada.
Richard Burton sort of inspired you to take up the theatre?
Yes, he did somewhat. He didn't know it at the time. We were Air Force cadets. It was a navigator school. We were training to be navigators, and he was hopeless, Richard. He really was. He used to, aircraft recognition, he used to get them all the wrong way around. He would confuse enemy with enemy and allied with allied. He would have shot down friends and failed to shoot down the enemy. And they used to call out, we used to have a roll of honour. You had to mark yourself. You lost for 8 points if you got them the wrong way around, and 6 points if they were the other way around, starting with 100. And it was Appleby, 42, sir. Brown, 18, sir. Burton, minus 265, sir. He was hopeless. But he was a very good rugby player and would have played for Wales if he hadn't been the great actor that he was. One day was Air Force Day when the public were invited in to watch us. We put up all these coconut shies and things, and Richard couldn't resist the platform. He was up there. What's he that wishes so? My cousin Westman, nay, fair cousin, wish not a man from a horse, my kingdom for a horse. And hang out your banners on the outward were all the great declamatory speeches. And I watched this audience standing there, absolutely gobsmacked by this giant standing there reciting this wonderful Shakespearean verse. And I thought that's not a bad thing to do, have people standing there with their mouths hanging wide open. I think I'll have a go at that. I didn't tell him until many years later, but he was certainly inspirational in that respect, yes.
As far as radio was concerned, obviously I understand that you were a great fan of the radio, as many actors of your ilk certainly were, but you have a bit of a passion for a radio programme that I can just about remember, and I think it had a quick burst on the television when I was a little girl.
Toytown.
Which was Toytown.
Oh, yes. Well, I modelled Alf Garnett on Mr. Grouser. I could always see Mr. Grouser lifting, actually going in vertical takeoff with rage. It's disgraceful. It ought not to be allowed. He would scream and shout. And it was, we all loved it, us kids, Larry the Lamb. Oh, Mr. Grouser, sir, please, you must excuse my little friend. He can't manage to turn the page, you see, with his hooves.
And there was a dachshund, Dennis
the dachshund, who had that wonderful German thing of putting the verb always at the end of it. That is a wonderful thing we are here to celebrate, yeah, that's right, my friend Larry Le Lamb. And there was Ernest the policeman, and the magician, and the mayor, who was pompous, and It was a wonderful, written by S.G. Hume Beeman, I think was the name of the... We used to hear that as children, didn't know who he was, but that was imprinted on one's memory, yes.
It's more true to life these days than probably it was then, thinking about it with a wry smile. Lots of TV, lots of film from the mid-50s. As I said, I mean, just looking through it all, it's quite extraordinary. But one thing that stands out in your career is Hancock's Half Hour.
Yeah, I went to audition for Hancock, and Sid James, who was a bit of a fan, a bit of a mate, came out and said, go in there and do your funny foreigner, you'll get it. So I went and did my funny foreigner, got the job. It was, Hancock was running a bookshop, and it was live in those days, no recording, and he used to get terribly nervous, and that's why, ladies and gentlemen, BBC are proud to present Hancock's Half Hour. That stammer was using his own terror. And in fact, my first entrance to Tony was in the... they came into the bookshop and he dried, stoned it, forgot his lines. And I remembered his lines and I said, excuse me, Master Hancock, a word in your ear. And I whispered his line. And he said, oh yes, thank you very much. And he went on and did a stunning show. And after, he said, I'm never doing a show without you. You're in, you're in. And I did about 13 Hancock's Half Hours on the trot. And he was very generous and helped me enormously. I've never found in the profession, they talk about it being a bitchy, catty profession, it isn't so. I found my colleagues to be very supportive and very helpful.
Hancock's Half Hour was very groundbreaking of the time in the same way that Alf Garnett was later on, because they were all eyebrow raisers, there's no doubt about that.
Well, Hancock was different in that it wasn't jokes, it was based on character, this extraordinarily overweening, vain man. It was a wonderful idea of Galton and Simpson, coming from railway cuttings East Cheam, as he did.
When were you first introduced to Alf Garnett?
I was rung up by Dennis Mayne Wilson from the BBC. Mitchell, Mayne Wilson here, sending a script round by taxi. Wonderful, wonderful half-hour show, and beg you to consider it. I said, when's this for? He said, rehearse next Monday. I said, I'm not working, Dennis, I'll do it. No, no, I want you to... Dennis Mayne Wilson was one of these wonderful BBC enthusiasts. There are not a lot of them left. He wanted a mountain to climb. He needed obstacles to overcome. And the fact that I was happy to do it anyway because I wasn't working, it really upset him. He wanted to persuade me to do it. But I read the script and I wasn't all that enamoured of it, except the opening joke, I thought, that's pretty good. As Alf is standing there by the radio and the radio's chiming, the Big Ben is chiming, and Alf looks at his watch and says, that bloody Big Ben's fast again. I've written to the Postmaster General. And the idea that he could reckon his tin hunter was more accurate than Big Ben, it appealed to me enormously. The dogmatic way in which he was always sure he was right. Yeah, I was sold on it. I mean, it was offered to Peter Sellers, who turned it down. And then I think Leo McKern was offered it, and he wasn't available. We could have had you could have had an Australian Alf, and I might have played Rumpole.
And what about Alf growing and creating him? Because presumably, once you'd got your teeth into him, then you developed the character.
Well, I suppose the way I overplayed it, it led Johnny into certain forms of writing. And I remember Frank Muir, who was assistant head of Light Entertainment, came to me and said, Warren, it's so abrasive. Couldn't you tone it down a little bit? When comedy shows were meant to be a bit nicer than that. And I said, no. He said, you don't seem to show any affection to your wife. I said, well, I don't have any. He was very worried that it was so abrasive. But he came to me 2 weeks later and said, I was absolutely wrong. It's wonderful, Warren. Don't change it. No, no, it's exactly right. And so he did remain abrasive and unsympathetic. And the minute you start trying to play for sympathy, of course, you lose it. A lot of people were sympathetic to this man who dug his own grave all the time and fell straight in.
But it was a wonderful family too. I mean, some of those conversations between Alf and Dandy Nichols, well, they weren't conversations because Dandy didn't have a great deal to say, but when she said it, she said it,
she said pig, and she said it with great emphasis. And she was absolute. She did make bricks without straw. She didn't have a lot to do in the script, but Dennis Mayne Wilson was brilliant in the way he cut to her face at certain moments in the middle of one of my diatribes. And that got the laugh. Just somebody once described her in the press as looking like a malevolent frog and looking disapproving of Alf. But she was wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Did you get on with her?
Yes, very well. Well, at the beginning, not so well. So I practiced my clarinet sometimes in the dressing room, and she had been married to a rather unsuccessful clarinetist. And so it brought back too many memories, and she would say, I wish you'd shut up. But in the end, I stopped taking my clarinet to rehearsals.
And things got better.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Eunice Stubbs, who I spoke to not too long ago and talked about her time in Till Death Us Do Part, went into raptures about your performances within that and what it was actually like, because she, like Dandy, didn't have a great deal to say.
No.
It was very much the fact of people being there. And of course, I mean, Alf had the lines and that was all there was to it. But she went into raptures about how wonderful it was to work with you and what a tight schedule the whole thing was.
It was indeed. I mean, I had 4 days to learn Mountains, but...
And was it live as well, the recording?
The early ones were all live, yes. Terrifying.
I find it quite extraordinary that Alf, being a complete and total Tory, as well as a bigot and all the other things that we can lay at his door, actually had a son-in-law who inevitably ended up being the father of a Labour Prime Minister's wife. We're talking about Cherie Blair here.
Yes, we're talking about a script which Johnny wrote called To Alf, a Grandson, which was never produced. It's a film script, which I regret has never been done, in which Alf does discover that his grandson is the Labour Prime Minister of Great Britain, and he's prepared to exploit it for as many pints of beer as he can, and bottles of whiskey too. The Tory party are prepared to finance this awful man, because every time he appears on television being interviewed, he gets a few more votes for the Tory party or against Labour. But that never got made.
In a way, you did a great deal to further the career of Mary Whitehouse as well. It occurred to me, because she was always there, and, I mean, every week she must have been glued to it. She must have been a pain.
The other way around. She was very useful to us. I mean, I remember the boss at Beeb, Sir Hugh Carlton Green, he came into rehearsal one day and said, another tirade by Mary Whitehouse. That's another 2.5 million viewers for us on Monday. Good old Mary. And she was our best publicist, no question.
What about a favourite episode there? Is there one particular episode that you would so love to see? A lot of the episodes have been lost, haven't they? Because
yes.
They didn't keep them.
Yeah, they couldn't afford to at the Beeb, you know, storing all those tapes. They need the tapes. Well, your wages have got to be paid somehow. I don't remember any one particular episode that I liked any more than any other. There's some lines that still remain with me. There's Alf bemoaning the fact that the bloody Labour Party... They give the empire away. I mean, bloody Gandhi wouldn't eat his dinner. They give him India. I think that is perhaps one of the greatest lines ever written. And you can always tell a true white man. He turns pink in the sun, not brown.
56 episodes, as you said, a lot of them produced live. The man that you created was very much a larger-than-life character, and again, thinking about him in contrast to today, when we're all taught to be so politically correct, Alf went completely the other way. A lot of people believed him as they saw him, and other people believed him as a satirical person, in which case you had a bite at two cherries rather than one, because there were two audiences.
A lot of people agreed with Alf, and they're stupid. I mean, there's nothing much you could do for them. I mean, a bloke came up to me at football one day, said, "Hey, Alf, I love that show of yours, you know." I said, "Actually, we're having a go on idiots like you." "What? What's he on about?" He didn't know what I was saying. The complaints that it enforced racism were nonsense. If people couldn't understand what Johnny was aiming at, then there was no hope for them anyway. People who agree with Alf, there is really no hope.
Do you think it could happen again today? I mean, do you think there could be a TV programme that went on and did that now?
Well, there are various TV programmes that do stretch the limits, that go as far as they can, and language and behaviour, sexual behaviour, and all sorts of things which pushing the envelope as far as they can. I'm sure that if somebody thought a series featuring a fascist, a member of the National Front... a real member of the National... If they thought there was money in it, they'd make it.
It's not just a product of the 60s either, is it? Because I know you very successfully toured with Alf, giving his all about some of the things that are going on now. But it's true to say that there aren't many people willing to stick their neck out like he did and you obviously creating this thing and continuing round. So it actually took a lot of guts to go out there and do it.
No, it didn't. It takes the ordinary guts that a performer needs to get up and believe, to have the arrogance to believe that people are prepared to pay £5-10 to come and listen to you. That's the conceit of the actor and the writer. Now, I do this one. I have this one-man show called The Thoughts of Chairman Alf, which I do periodically around the place, and which I love doing. It means that Alf hasn't died.
A lot of people who have been involved in a character as strong as Alf's would say, and indeed do say to me quite often, that particular character, whoever it may be, has become a complete albatross in their life. You've actually turned that round to an advantage rather than a disadvantage, because you have done so many other great parts where, although maybe the anticipation of an audience that hasn't seen you live is expecting Alf Garnett to come walking out, within seconds there is no trace of Alf anywhere to be found. That, of course, is a great testament to you, but as far as carrying Alf around all your life is concerned, he's a bit of a burden or not?
No, I live in a very pleasant house in Highgate in London. I have a reasonable financial status, and much of it is due to Alf, and I couldn't possibly knock it. And I had a little bit of recognition, and most actors spend their lives unemployed, longing for a chance such as Alf Garnett represented for me. I wouldn't knock it, no. And the most important thing about it was that the chance to say those wonderful lines, and most actors have at some time or other in their life to play in rubbish. And I look at many of those who are participating in soaps and think, oh, you poor love, you having to say that crap every week. How awful. But I've had the joy of, in recent years, of Arthur Miller, Harold Pinter and Johnny Spate, to name but three.
It's not bad, it's worth banking, isn't it, that? Mm, so absolutely. Is home in London, because you also enjoy Australia quite a bit, don't you?
Mm. Yes, I started going there some years ago because I'm a sailor and I was invited to do the Hobart race, which I never did do, but I went out there and I found a little gold mine in travelling around the clubs and doing Alf as a stand-up, which they loved. The show was probably even more popular over there than in England because it was anarchic. And Australians are by nature a bit anarchic, you know, mate. They love that bit when you chuck that ink pot in the Queen's face. Gee, that was marvellous, Alf, you know. Ripper, a real ripper. The bloke just came over here, an Australian came over here just now and said hello. I became an Australian citizen about 10 years ago now. They said to me when I went into immigration one year, bloke said, you're going to lose your resident status, Alf, but I've worked out, mate, that according to your passport, you're eligible. On February the 10th, have half your brain removed, you can become an Australian citizen. So I did. And they televised it live, my ceremony, because they were trying to persuade all these poms who've gone to Australia and never taken out naturalisation papers. So I have this dichotomy, which is a word I've been longing to use. Thank you for being here. I have this, particularly in sporting events, when Australia are playing anybody except England, but it has to be the country of origin for me with sport, when England are playing Australia at cricket.
Tell me, what is it? What is the perfect day off for you?
Oh, sailing. Get on a boat and hoist the sails and away. That's a perfect day off. I went to a sailing school sometime in the 50s, 60s, 60s it was. And in Torquay, and I learned to sail, and I was caught. It's an incurable disease once you get it. And I bought my first boat, and since then I've sailed in all sorts of waters and all sorts of racing and cruising, and it is for me the and being here in Cambridge, right on top of the water there, is just magic. Just to be near water.
I'm dying to see you on a punt. That would be a good start, wouldn't it, really?
Yeah. I was at Oxford and I never was much good punting. No good at all.
That's because you're a physicist, isn't it?
I don't know. That's a good excuse, thank you. No, I'm sorry, I can't punt. I'm a physicist.
Exactly. You love your sailing. You obviously love your life. You're very pleased with where you are at the moment. So why are
smug, you mean?
Working? No, I didn't say that. Why are you working your way around provincial theatres when you could be enjoying your day in the sunshine?
Because, I suppose, I've got a daft idea that it is the actor's job to take the play out of the West End and take it round all over the country if we're asked. It would be dreadful if actors refused to tour. It's not all that jolly to pack a case and go and live in a hotel. I just think it's part of the actor's job to live out of a suitcase and take your work around the country and let everybody see it.
The wonderful Warren Mitchell, who died at the age of 89 this weekend.
Mid-mornings with Phil Rowe.
Exactly, coming up on 11:30, which is high time then to meet our guest this morning. He appeared with Lee Chambers just a couple of months ago on Cambridge 105, and where he's found time to come in to do this today, heaven only knows, but it's lovely to see him this morning. Lovely guy, as I say earlier on, and it's a very good morning to Paul Richards, who's Hello, with us today. Hello, Paul. All right. I mean, did you get much sleep last night? What were you, I mean, you gig everywhere. I know earlier this week you were out doing something. I think it was on Monday.
Where was I on Monday?
You've forgotten already. This is Wednesday.
Yes, I'm blimey. Generally, where was I on Monday?
I know what it's like. I know
what
it's like.
I can check the schedule if you like, but no, I had a gig last night as well, actually.
All over the country. Do you generally gig locally, though, when you can?
It depends. With the band, no, really. We're all over. We've got the big Cambridge gig coming up with the Fred's House Christmas party, 17th of December, I believe. But apart from that, we're just touring constantly, which is nice. And I'll start my UK tour on the 1st of December with the new Christmas show, which I haven't finished writing yet.
It's a pantomime.
The pantomime's after that, actually.
Oh.
So I've got various Christmas projects, all of which I'm way behind on at the moment, which is a concern. But so it's a solo show called Rudolph at Last, The True Story, which is me on an exercise bike shouting for an hour dressed as a reindeer, that opens in Beckles on the 1st of December. And then tours for 9 nights. And then my musical opens a day later, which I've only written, and so everyone else is rehearsing it, which is quite nice. And then the panto opens on the 20th of December, which is worrying, isn't it, really?
Knowing you, though, you get it all in on time. Everybody worries about you, Paul, that you're not going to get it finished because you're taking on too much, but it always works out for
it's
you in the end, doesn't it?
I think you saw me outside a bit ago, knocking back a Red Bull before I came in here. So
I did actually spy you out the window of the building doing that in the car. So it's lovely to see you today. We should explain to listeners that apart from obviously doing your solo comedy, that you're a drummer for the local band Fred's House.
Of course, yeah.
And also when I first met you, actually, my eyes wouldn't have met yours, of course, but I was in the St. John's College Chapel for the recent Dowsing Sound Collective.
Great gig,
wasn't
it? Yeah,
it was. About 3 months ago, and there you were, spotlighted along with about 50 choral members of Dowsing Sound.
Over 100 of them, I think, actually, yeah.
Was it getting off that stage?
There's quite a few of them, but yeah.
I was amazed you could squeeze everyone into the back end of St. John's Chapel.
I know,
I think
we were quite worried about that gig, but it came out really well in the end, because sometimes it doesn't. So, I mean, I think that was a good one, actually. So
it was two performances, and I went to the earlier one on the Sunday.
That's the better one, yeah.
Oh, was it?
I think so, yeah.
Children went along to that one.
Cool.
So, obviously you've got a lot of talent. You can drum. How did this start for you? I was saying to you earlier on, wasn't it the case of, you know, there were a few empty cans of baked beans in the kitchen when you were young, and you started tapping on those and banging out a ribbon? Rhythm, even.
That to a certain extent. Also, my father was a professional drummer, and ironically, he played for Graham Parker, who's one of the people that ended up sacking me for the film. But Graham Parker didn't know that. Didn't know who my dad was, because obviously it's like in the early 70s when they were best friends at school, and then everyone loses touch over the years. And then of all the celebrities that I emailed about this film, Graham Parker was one of the few that actually came back saying, yeah, I'll do it. And he kind of double-checked me. I was like, he looks familiar, because I look quite similar to my dad. I don't know if he's got the link at all yet, but it's the same surname, same face. So it's quite ironic, really, that in real life, sort of 30 years later, there's another meeting. So, yeah.
So we played 50 Ways to Lose Your Lover just now, and you took that song, because you obviously heard it being played on the radio somewhere, into 50 Ways to sort of sack your drummer, wasn't it?
To leave your drummer. So I heard one of my favourite songwriters, Ed Harcourt, covered it on a radio show recently, and it was last year, and I thought, that's a great tune. I actually misheard it, and I actually heard the word drummer. And then
we've got the Ed Harcourt version, but we won't play that, because the Paul Simon one, but it's actually up on our system, I noticed, as well.
Great version, actually. I think it's a live version, isn't it? But yes, I heard that, I misheard it. I thought, that's a great title. And then things just spiralled.
Started off as a bit of a joke, just a low-volume level. A few local musicians, people you knew around the area.
Yeah, I was at the Edinburgh Fringe at the time, I think, actually. And I got a few buskers to sack me, a few friends who were busking to earn a bit of extra cash at the Fringe. And then took it back to Cambridge, got a few more. Then after about 20, the joke wore thin. So had to look elsewhere, really, for my acts.
And that was in August, wasn't it? Yeah, the end of August for the Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah, last year.
Last year.
This one's taken a bit longer than my usual projects, but
all done on a phone. All the filming, all the shooting.
Retrospect mistake, I'll be honest with you, because I didn't realise it's going on in the cinema, and it's a huge screen. I was there the other day and I looked at it and I swore quite loudly because it looks great on my laptop, but this is going to be an issue, isn't it? But we're going with it now, and I think there's and we'll see what happens, really, won't we?
Arts Picture House Friday evening. We'll give it another plug towards the end of the interview. And they moved you over to Screen One as well now, Paul.
Potentially, yes, at the moment. It depends on the ticket sales. It looks like we're about to head over to Screen One, because it was moved to Screen 2 originally because of the size of the film, and I didn't want it to go on such a massive screen because it might be pixelated. But ticket sales, there's been a good buzz about this one, which is a worry, isn't it?
I've seen some of the preview, actually all of the preview, because you've actually put a little debut premiere preview a bit up online, and there's a link. We'll tell people, or show people how, or instruct them, we'll make them go and have a look at this a bit later on, Paul. I will give them the link in just a little while. Yes. But I've actually captured a little bit of the clip now, just to give a flavour of how this all sounds.
Awesome. I'm here to do a drum solo for you, is that okay? If I start doing a solo,
and it's the debut of their brand new drummer, Mr. Paul Richards, everybody!
You call yourself a drummer? You don't seem to own a string vest, you've got no tattoos, you don't take drugs, you don't drink.
It is the bare minimum requirement of being a drummer to have a drum kit to play. If you've got another song,
The gig's in half an hour.
You're doing things right, some right things, but I don't know whether they're the wrong right things.
That reminds me a bit of the Andre preview sketch that Morecambe and Wise did. I'm playing the notes, but not necessarily in the right order. Do you remember that one?
I remember that.
Seen the clip. You're probably too young for that one.
No, I've definitely seen that.
I sense a sort of real innocence about this film. There's nothing sort of sinister, or, you know, it's just fun.
It really is, actually. And it's the nicest film going. And we've had to make it an 18 for Friday because of the late license at the bar. But really, it's a PG. I think we've actually cut out the swear words on there as well, so there's two swear words in the whole film. So,
because I was going to ask you about the 18 certificate, I was thinking, for what I've seen, this is, you know, I could send my little aunt along to see this, and she wouldn't be offended at all.
Not at all, no. It's just a nice little tragic documentary, really. So in the nicest possible way. So.
It's sad, isn't it? They put you on it so late on a Friday evening.
Yeah, I guess we had to compete with other films otherwise. So when you book a slot at a cinema, if you're going to take a screen, you'd have to kind of do better than the films on already, so we're going to compete with James Bond at this stage.
But another way to look at it, perhaps, is everybody's been down to the bar and had a nice meal out and wants to stay in Cambridge and go along to see.
Yes, I shall certainly be quite drunk.
50 ways to sack your drink.
It's more of a celebration, a party, to sort of celebrate the fact that this film actually happened, because it's been dragging on a while, and at one point I was stuck on about 30 sackings, and I just needed to push over the finishing line, and it's a victory for all involved, and a lot of lovely people have helped me out with this, and I do appreciate it. So.
I love that you got Arthur Smith. I just love the attitude of Arthur Smith. He's great.
He really lovely bloke, actually. Yeah, I met him because I was a bit worried, because he was doing it was backstage in Soho, and he was doing a show with he was doing Leonard Cohen songs that day, so a big Soho run, and I was a bit concerned about meeting him and stuff, and I turned up and he was waiting at the bar for me, and such a nice man, actually, and dedicated a lot of time to it as well, actually. So.
Are you just pulling her legs when you said that he made you dress up in a skirt?
He did, actually, yes. That was his way of sacking me, because to make me dress like his backing singers, basically, and I don't have the body for that at all, you know, so I was especially in the skirt they made me wear.
Shave your short, fat, hairy legs that day.
If anything, they've shown a bit too much, and maybe it's an 18 after all, we don't know, but
that's probably why we've got the 18 certificate, isn't it? So avert your gaze now, but I didn't see you in I saw Arthur, obviously. Arthur comes up on the screen and does what the excerpt that we've just heard. I didn't actually catch you in your penny at that stage.
We'll save that for the premiere, actually.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So, all the travelling you did, because you did this on location, not just seeing Arthur and meeting him down in London, but you went down to the South Coast too as well. You were in Southampton doing this.
Yeah, I was actually doing a solo show that night, and I needed an encore, and I didn't have one, so I'd just been before my Edinburgh show then, which is like a good hour-long show, and they wanted more from me, so I said, look, can you sack me? It's a really strange request, and so, both Southampton and Beccles, actually, I ended up, just being sacked by the audience. And it was very nice. It was like, Graham Parker said later on as well about going solo, so we managed to get a bit of a plot out of it, which is quite nice.
That's fantastic. I know a lot of people on Facebook have said some marvellous and very humorous things about what they've seen from the clip and some of the stills that you've put up there as well. Yeah. And one was a large sort of almost a 50-piece string orchestra, and you're banging the timpani, isn't it? I think in the corner.
That was weird, wasn't it? my good friends Claire and Steve Calder, who used to be in the band with years ago, they're in an orchestra in Sudbury, and they just got me involved with this, and I don't think the rest of the orchestra were really in on the joke, so it was very, very confusing, where I had to play Mikado as badly as possible, that was an odd one, but then again, the whole film's quite odd, because obviously I'm a professional drummer, and I was concerned actually at some point I'll get a reputation of being a bad drummer, because I've been sacked 50 times. I've never actually been sacked in real life, so this is
many people around Cambridge, Paul, know that that's not true, actually, and they only have to listen to you working with Fred's House, which is a favourite band of ours here in Cambridge 105, to know that that's really not true. Did you have to give the lines to the people, you know, like the conductor who wanted to sack you at, say, in the string orchestra there, or was it very, very spontaneous?
It's mostly spontaneous. I gave a lot of people hints of where I wanted it to go. So for Frank Turner, for example, I kind of said, here's the joke. I've turned up, I haven't got a drum kit with me. I thought that was a house kit. And then he was probably the most sweariest person we've had so far, but again, Frank Turner, his management was so keen for this to happen as well, actually, they were, because we missed out on them on several occasions. I messed up on they wanted to set me at the Royal Albert Hall, but I was on tours in Nottingham at the time, so I couldn't physically get there in time. Then I messed up with getting into the Cambridge Folk Festival and all that stuff, and so eventually I was in Edinburgh and he was in Glasgow, and we agreed to somehow make it work, in which I, in between my two shows that day, I nipped on the train, got across to Glasgow, he sat me, got back on the train, did my evening show, they were lovely people to work with, as everyone was as well. That's the thing.
You've emailed something like 900 celebrities in order to actually get the sort of 50 that eventually you ended up with, including Kimberly Rue, who lives just around the corner from us, obviously from Katrina and the Waves, writing some of the songs for that band, including the Eurovision Song Contest
of course,
and people like that. But Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull, I mean, that, well done to get
that was a strange one, actually, because we were very very worried about that, because obviously he sold about 60 million records worldwide, such a megastar, and we turned up and they asked us to come back in an hour's time, and we actually met him at his house, because he's got a studio in his grounds of his house, which was and I think it's the grounds of his house are bigger than Soham, where I live, so it's a different world altogether, and I think we were told we could have about 3 minutes with him, and we stayed for about 10 in the end. He was such a lovely bloke, and once he realised we weren't weirdos, it was a thoroughly enjoyable experience, and he really got into the idea of it.
You're a real live wire, Paul. It's great to meet you. You're going to be doing Rudolph at Last the True Story, the most signally happy Christmas show you'll ever see. And that's going to be on at the Arts House here in Cambridge on Friday the 4th of December at 7:30.
It's in Arts House in Southampton.
The Arts House in Southampton. It's not the Arts Picture House. I'm getting confused.
Too many shows.
Down in Southampton again.
Yes, same venue that sat me. I'm good friends with the owners now, so they keep rebooking, which is nice. That's the UK tour. It ends up, I'm not in Cambridge that way, I'm in Shepworth, which is quite close, isn't it? So I'm at the Plough in Shepworth on the 9th of December for that one.
People are asking if you're going to be doing this locally, so that's the nearest one.
Yes, but my panto, which opens on the 20th and 23rd of December, that's at CB2 in Cambridge. That's the world's first ever Britpop panto, which is a very last minute thing, but I have too much time sometimes.
I don't think you have enough time. You're going to give yourself a rest over Christmas?
No, because January, I think, actually, because no one goes to shows in January.
So the usual month when local live bands give everything a bit of a rest. January, when they
catch up on a bit of sleep with us, and then February back on tour again, so it's rather exciting.
You're a real live wire clock spring. You're lovely to meet, Paul, and it's nice that we've been able to get together like this before you disappear off and get this panto written.
Yes.
One more time then for a plug for this particular one. So it's going to be, is tickets still are going? For
Yes, definitely. So it's 11:45 p.m, which is a very late screening, but we'll be there much earlier getting drunk. So come and come and join us. You might need it. And yeah, it's 11:45 at the Arts Picture House. I'm not sure what screen at this stage, but it's unreserved seating, so just buy tickets if you can. And it lasts about an hour and 10 minutes. I think we've got the bar till 2 a.m. afterwards as well, so let's have a party.
Merry old time.
Yes.
Sounds great. Good. I'm more and more tempted, I have to say.
Yes, please do.
Some members of the team are going along to see it.
Awesome.
So, tickets left there. As I say, go to Arts Picture House to get your tickets. 50 Ways to Leave Your Drummer. It is Paul Richards, and he put together that bit of comedy. Go along. Yeah, perhaps before the pub or after the pub, whichever way, before the bar or after the bar, anyway. Preferably, probably, I don't know which way around, before.
Before.
Oh, right. Thanks very much for joining us this morning. It's a lovely little bit of humour as well this morning on that little clip that we had earlier on. And I'll have to meet Arthur Smith one day. But thanks very much.
Cheers. Thank you.
Mid-mornings with Mike Breyer. Cambridge 105.
And time to welcome into the studio my guest from Cambridge's Addenbrookes Hospital, consultant transplant surgeon Kurosh Saib Parsi. Good morning.
Good morning.
And how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to join you on your program today.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So we'll get started, but obviously the news this morning is very, very specific and very relevant, I guess, in terms of the NHS. 98% of junior doctors have voted in favour of strike. Can I just get your reaction to that?
Absolutely. I mean, doctors are absolutely committed to the National Health Service, and the last thing they want to do is anything that compromises either patients or the National Health Service in the long term. I'm not a junior doctor, so I wasn't involved in the ballot. But I can tell you that, you know, from our perspective, this is unprecedented. 98% of junior doctors deciding to take or consider strike action is really a really strong message of the level of frustration that is currently prevalent within the health system. And I think it's really important that real efforts are made to really ensure that the doctors are committed, as they are, but are able to produce the high quality of service that they can do. And really, I think this is a very important task for the government to try and sort out.
Well, thanks very much for your comments. I say we'll not dwell on that, but I just thought it was relevant for us to at least ask the question this morning.
Of course.
So organ transplant, a subject that I'm sure everybody's very familiar with in terms of what it's all about. How long's organ transplants been going so far? I mean, I seem to recall probably some of the early ones would be things like kidneys, but when did it all start?
That's right. So doctors and surgeons have really been trying to do transplantation for a long time, for over a century, and of course the initial ones were unsuccessful. The first successful kidney transplants were done in the 50s, and the initial problem were twofold. One was the technical ability to perform an operation that was successful, and the second challenge was really the fact that if you transplant an organ from one person to the next, because the cell type or the tissue type between those are different, the organ is rejected. So until really we understood what causes rejection and how we can overcome it using immunosuppression, then transplant wasn't really commonplace.
So in those early days of the first transplants, did they even realize that there would be organ rejection?
Not in the initial ones. And in fact, the very first transplants were not performed between humans. They were done, for example, from monkeys to humans and so on. And of course, all these transplants failed, but provided really important information in terms of what we currently know about transplantation. It is, I mean, in terms of major development, Cambridge has actually been, I'm pleased to say, the forefront of transplantation worldwide. The very first liver transplantation outside of the US was done in Cambridge, in Addenbrookes Hospital. And in 2018, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of that. So really, liver transplantations have been done for about 50 years, and kidney transplantations for...
And I guess just up the road at Papworth, of course, the first heart transplants were done.
Absolutely, and still really fantastic innovative work is being done both in Addenbrookes and in Papworth in order to try and increase the benefit of what is really a life-saving treatment to patients. The fact of the matter is that we have a large number of people die every day because of a relative lack of access to organs that we can transplant. Just to put that in context, in the UK alone, 1,000 people die every year because we don't have enough organs for them to transplant. Now you think, well, maybe 1,000 is not a lot, but it's the equivalent of 3 jumbo jets crashing with everybody on board dying every year. That's a jumbo jet every 4 months. Now if that was happening in any other sphere, if really there was a tragedy like a jumbo jet crashing every 4 weeks, the whole country would really be absolutely focused to try and sort this problem.
And the key thing there is, it is a problem that can be sorted, really.
Absolutely. We do know what the solution to this is. We know that transplantation is life-saving for a whole variety of diseases and conditions, kidney failure, liver failure, heart failure, and so on. And really, in the first instance, the most effective solution to this problem is for as many people to donate their organs after they pass away, so that as many lives can be saved.
Now, the thing about organ donation, you know, I can't ever remember a time, and I'm pretty old now, I can't ever remember a time that they haven't been banging on about people signing up to the organ donation register and so on. And yet we still, you know, all these decades later, we still have it as an issue. Why do you think that people don't sign up then?
Absolutely. Well, I think the first thing to say is that we really have made great strides, and we have improved, and the number of donors that we have in the UK are now much greater than they were, say, 5-10 years ago. So this is having some good impact, which is very positive. But it's also true to say that probably our donation rates aren't as high as some other countries, such as Spain. So there's still much room for improvement. I think part of it really stems from trying to educate everybody, both patients, but also their relatives, and really everybody, to ensure that they're aware of the benefits they can do and the lives that they can save. The other thing to really mention is that actually more people are able to donate organs than you would think of. In other words, these days, it's not quite uncommon for me to have a conversation where somebody says, well, you know, I'm 65, I'm too old to donate organs. Well, the answer is not. We are now accepting organs from donors who are in their 70s or even in their 80s.
So just let me be clear on that, because you know, I perhaps, like many people, kind of... without saying it, thought that the organs in your body, along with the rest of your body, would age at the same rate. And so you ultimately would get to a point where the organs would not really be very viable. So somebody, let's say, who was 70, you know, the point of they donating a kidney, say, to a 20-year-old would not be a reasonable proposition. I mean, is that a true statement?
Well, that's very, very true, yes. And that's a very... accurate assessment of the situation. The organs do age, and for example, a kidney who has been donated by a 70-year-old is, of course, not as, if you like, good quality as a kidney that may be donated from the 20-year-old. But there's a couple of things to mention here. First of all, the number of donors that we have in this country who are very young is fortunately very low. That's good news, because it means that we don't have a large number of young people dying from road traffic accidents and so on. So that's a positive thing. But it does mean that the vast majority of organs that we have actually come from older donors, or perhaps donors who have had other previous medical problems. They may have had high blood pressure, they may have had heart disease or diabetes. So most of the organs that we have are secondhand organs, and they are not perfect organs. The other factor to bear in mind is that we have a lot of patients who are on the waiting list, and these patients themselves are older. So you're absolutely right. While we would try and avoid giving a kidney transplant from a 70-year-old donor to a 20-year-old recipient, we have lots of patients who are on the waiting list who are in their 60s and 70s, and therefore it would be perfectly, it would give perfectly good outcomes for that patient, and the results would be very good if the organ transplant is done from a 70-year-old donor to, for example, a roughly 70-year-old recipient. And age is one of the things that we try to match in order to make sure that we get the best use of the organs.
Right, because I don't know if you've caught it, but there is a program on TV, series on TV, The Gift of Life, just now, which Absolutely. Is all about this.
That's
and
right.
And one of the things that struck me in watching that was that even when you get what appears to be a viable donation, there are clearly issues to do with matching it with the recipient. And it's not just about blood type and things like that. There are, I guess, other reasons why you reject it. Because I was quite surprised to find that some of the patients featured in that TV program had been up for taking an organ several times. And then when the organ eventually reached the hospital, they'd found that it wasn't a perfect match for whatever reason.
Absolutely. We have a very thorough careful assessment process to make sure that the organs that we do eventually transplant are of good quality and that the recipients have are likely to have very good outcomes. And this means performing a whole series of different tests, both in terms of how good a match is that organ for that patient, and this includes sophisticated tests to look at the cell types, for example, and how closely they are related or different between the donor and the recipient, but also testing the organs themselves to look for any possible problems, any possible disease in the organs, but also to ensure that the function is good of that organ. And this includes really some sophisticated and state-of-the-art tests that we are able to do in Addenbrooke's at the moment.
One of the issues that you mentioned earlier on, there is something like 1,000 people a year that receive, or die rather, from waiting for organs and so forth. Give us some sort of idea as to the time scale that people are waiting for organs, because I suspect it's probably a lot longer than people realize.
It is, and it's a lot longer than people realize, but it's also dependent on the particular organ. So the most common transplant in the UK of a solid organ is a kidney transplant. And in the UK, the average waiting time for a kidney transplant is about 2.5 to 3 years. That's the average time.
And all that time they'll be on dialysis, I guess.
The vast majority, yes, they will be on dialysis. Mm. And that's the average time. Of course, what that means is that some people would wait naturally shorter time. They may wait a year or a year and a half, whereas other people may wait much longer, for example 5 years or 10 years, and it is possible for people to be on the waiting list for a very long time and not eventually be able to be transplanted.
And the majority of reasons for that would just simply be getting the correct match, would it?
It would be getting the correct match, but also organ of the good quality, sufficient quality and match.
And on the other side of the coin, as it were, the recipient, all that time, and I'm not obviously a medical person, so I don't know what the situation is, but whilst, let's take kidneys as an example, whilst they're on dialysis, would they be deteriorating or could they be kept stable? So what I'm saying is, would they become a point, as indeed was highlighted in this TV program, where the actual recipient was too ill to be able to receive?
Absolutely. That's also a very important point. The technology for dialysis and dialysis as a treatment has substantially improved over recent years, and we're pretty good at dialyzing patients. But still, dialysis only really replaces a small percentage of a person's kidney function. So being on dialysis from a health point of view is not a good thing, and itself is associated with lots of problems and bad outcomes. So it is not uncommon at all for patients to be on a waiting list, either for a kidney transplant or a liver transplant, and ultimately be removed from that list because they're actually no longer healthy enough to receive a transplant. And another tragedy, as we started by saying, was that actually a lot of these people simply die on the waiting list while waiting for an organ, and that's a real tragedy.
So clearly one of the focuses that, you know, I'd like to get out of this morning's discussion is the idea of how can people, you know, how can we make it easier for people to get involved in the whole donation scheme? Because several of the issues I'll run by you. First off, I suspect in a lot of cases, if they're not signed up to the register, coming to relatives of somebody who's died or is about to die at that point in their lives clearly at a very emotional time, not a good time to be making decisions of that nature. So I would suspect it's far better if that kind of decision can be made at a time when there isn't that sort of pressure going on.
Absolutely, that's very true. Obviously, we do have a process in place whereby highly trained specialist nurses in organ donation will approach families to discuss organ donation with them. But you're absolutely right. This is, they're going through a very difficult time. And actually, we are always overwhelmed by the level of support that these families have. And despite the difficulties that they're going through, often they are very pro-donation and would like a good outcome, at least one good outcome, to come from the death of their loved ones.
And what about, I guess there must be a main route that people can, the organ donation register, people can make that declaration. But are there other ways? I mean, there was in the news quite recently a very altruistic woman who was contacted with somebody who was requiring, I think it was a kidney actually, on Facebook. And this person just saw the call for help on Facebook, and completely unconnected to the person making the call, out in a very altruistic way, actually decided to give her organ, a second organ.
That's right. In principle, organs can of course come from two type of donors. One are donors that have passed away because of whatever condition, and then it's usually either they themselves have given advanced instructions by registering with the organ donor register and they would like their organs donated, or the permission or the consent for that donation comes from their relatives. But there are also people who donate, living people who donate their organs. Most commonly it's the kidney that they donate, but it's also possible to, for example, donate part of a person's liver to somebody else.
So the liver can, part of it, you say?
That's
so
right.
A part of it can be cut from the donor, and yet they still survive, okay?
That's right. Part of it is cut from the donor and transplanted into another patient. Quite often this other patient is a child, but it can be another adult. And there are, again, very strict criteria for deciding when this is appropriate. But essentially, the outcomes are good for both the donor and the recipient. The issue of altruistic donation that you mentioned is also very important. Of course, people do altruistic donations all the time. When you think about blood donation or bone marrow donation, that's precisely what that is. The difference with something like kidney donation, it's that it involves a major operation.
And also, whereas blood, to be simplistic about it, they hook you up and they suck it out your body, but then very soon it's replenished, isn't it? Whereas if you take a kidney, then it's gone.
Absolutely. So we have, precisely for those reasons, we have very, again, strict criteria for who is who we accept to become a living donor, and we do a variety of tests to make sure that they're healthy and that they've got renal function. The one thing I would say, though, that we do know that people who donate one kidney in the long term actually live very healthy and normal lives. In fact, if you just compare them to the average population, the people who donate their kidney, one kidney, they actually live longer and live healthier lives. The reason for that, of course, is that they are a very selected population. You can only go on to donate a kidney if you are really healthy and there's nothing wrong with you.
Right.
And then donating one kidney doesn't have... it has some potential long-term consequences. So you can imagine if you donated one kidney and you're in a car accident and the other kidney is damaged, then, of course, you would require dialysis. But the risks of those things happening are generally very low.
Yes.
So people who donate one kidney... go on to do live healthy lives. And in Addenbrooke's, we probably transplant something like about 50 kidney transplants every year from living donors to recipients. The vast majority of those are related recipients, so they may be spouse, children or parents or friends, but some of them are, as you said, altruistic donors. So that's somebody saying, look, I want to do something important and donate my kidney.
Our time is almost up. Let me just ask you one more question, which is because it's been in the news this week, as I mentioned earlier on, about facial donation. There was a chap in a firefighter in America who was caught
that's
in a fire,
right,
and
right.
You probably saw it on the news
that's
yourself.
Right.
And remarkable, because his face was completely destroyed, and yet now with the facial donation from somebody who was obviously died, he's to some degree got his identity back again there.
Absolutely.
In what watching it, it looked like all his nerves weren't working because he didn't have a lot of control over things like his lips and his eyelids and so on. But where are we in terms of, you know, the leading edge or the cutting edge of organ donation? I mean, what do you feel is possible in the next few years?
Absolutely. So while we've been doing kidney transplantation and liver transplantation and heart transplantation for decades, transplanting either limbs or face is relatively more new, and it has its own challenges. So connection of nerves, for example, that you mentioned is one of the important ones. Treatment of rejection is another example. But facial transplantation, that particular example was very complex. It was very complete. They included the scalp and ears and so on. And as you say, while technically speaking, that transplant was not a life-saving transplant because the patient was alive, but actually in terms of quality of life, everybody would agree that made an enormous impact. So those sort of transplants, I think, will continue. But there is also really cutting edge and innovation being done for things like kidney transplantation or liver transplantation. You know, here locally in Cambridge, one of the things that really I think exciting to think about is our ability recently to be able to perfuse organs like kidneys on a machine with blood and actually not only assess them to see whether they are functioning okay, but also perhaps treat them and modify them and take an organ which was perhaps not ideal and treat it with drugs or under conditions, which means this organ is likely to be more beneficial when it's transplanted. And we have a program here in Cambridge, which is led by Professor Michael Nicholson, and it's really the world leader in terms of resuscitating and assessing kidneys using machine perfusion. So that's really one of the exciting things that are currently going on.
Can you quote a statistic? Out of all the kidneys that are made available for donation, what percentage of those are actually viable and can be used?
So we obviously have a selection process in terms of which donors we consider for transplantation. So when a potential donor is considered, we go through their past medical history, the blood results, and then decide whether that donor is potentially suitable or not. Once we accept a particular donor, then it's only a small percentage, probably about 10 or so kidneys that are turned down. But that's for kidneys. For other organs, for example, such as pancreases, we do pancreas transplantation for diabetes, up to about 50% of the organs that we'd receive are ultimately turned down because of concerns about quality. So again, there's a lot of scope for improvement in those areas.
Well, Kourosh, obviously, thank you very much for coming in. Incredibly interesting subject, an incredibly important subject and so on. I always ask my guests when they come in about contact information, and I can't think of anything more important than to give out information about how people can get involved in the organ donation scheme. Do you have some information that you might have?
Absolutely. I mean, the best source of contact really is NHS Blood and Transplant. And there's a wealth of information on there about transplantation, about how to become a donor, how to register on the organ donor register. So really, a Google search of NHS Blood and Transplant or NHSBT will bring up the site, and that would be my first port of call.
And you know, really all that I guess involves is signing up to it, obviously telling your close friends and family that that's a decision that you've made.
Absolutely. What I would strongly urge people to do is to talk about organ donation, talk about what they would want to do in the event that they die. It's not a good topic to think about, but if the eventuality happens, I mean, I would personally would want to think that actually somebody would benefit from my death. So talk about it, sign up on the organ donor register, and tell your family and friends.
Well, thanks ever so much, as I say, for coming in this morning too, and we've well gone past our time limits, but I thought it was an important subject, so once again, thanks ever so much.
Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you.
Kourosh Sahib Parsi as a consultant transplant surgeon from Addenbrooke's Hospital, and no doubt you'll agree with me that he does an incredibly important work, and we must say thank you to all the doctors and nurses in our NHS for the work that they do.
Mid-mornings with Lee Chambers. Cambridge 105.
I've got Karen Thomas sitting in front of me. Hello, Karen.
Hi, Lee.
You're community officer at Kettle's Yard.
That's right, yes.
That sounds a lovely job.
It's the best job. It really is. I'm so lucky. But Kettle's Yard is a really magical place to work.
And it's very community-based, isn't it? For those who haven't been there, just tell us a little bit about Kettle's Yard.
Yeah, so Kettle's Yard is a house and art gallery with an amazing collection of modern art. And the gallery shows changing exhibitions of modern and contemporary art. But we're actually closed at the moment for a big redevelopment, which is happening at the moment. And we're building a brand new education wing, which means we can welcome more people into Kettle's Yard. And there will be a brand new cafe, which
oh,
is
a cafe,
important.
You've got me now. A coffee.
With very delicious coffee and tea.
Absolutely.
And so that means that we can do a lot more out and about in the community. And that's my role, really, is to go and talk to people about Kettle's Yard and about the fantastic artists that we work with.
And this project, Open House, this is very community-based, isn't it? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so as a house, Kettle's Yard is all about opening its doors to the local community. And I think we have a responsibility to, you know, we're a house in a street, in a neighbourhood.
Because it is a house, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a kind
house.
Of a converted... When you say that, it literally is a converted house.
It literally
beautifully
is a house.
Converted, but yeah. It was a house.
Yeah, so it was home to a man called Jim and his wife, Helen Ead. And they moved there in the late 1950s and developed Kettle's Yard as we know it now. Jim was curator at the Tate, and he had this amazing collection of what was then contemporary art, and now we know as modern art, with artists like Ben Nicholson and Winifred Nicholson and Barbara Hepworth and Henry Moore. And he really believed in art as having a power to make you feel restored and relaxed. And that's kind of what our open house artist in residence, Emma Smith, has been looking at, is how you feel relaxed and restored at home. So she's been out and about in North Cambridge for the past 6 months, collecting all sorts of ideas of how people feel relaxed in their own home. And it's been amazing, the things that people do and the things that Emma's done with people as well in their own home. So she's been out singing karaoke with one gentleman in his own home. That makes him feel relaxed. Maybe he's been singing along this morning, I don't know. She's been doing some gardening up at the allotments. She's been knitting and crocheting, playing word games with people and talking to them about how they feel better.
Well, I'm going to scrap now that you've got the best job in the world, because she's got the best job in the
true.
World. That's so really, she has really been going out into the community. And now she's take. What's she going to do with all that information?
So she's been gathering all these ideas and all of this advice, and she's creating a pop-up chemist, I suppose, at 78 Akeman Street, which is the former Maskell's bakery.
And Akeman Street, is that's in Arbury, is
that's
it?
That's right, yeah. So it's just off Histon Road. Turn down there and keep going. For those who know the Maskell's bakery that was there, which I know was very popular and made very good bread. So she's going to be in there. She's completely transformed it. And it's going to be a pop-up shop where people can go in and get free advice and free suggested activities that they can feel relaxed at home as well, which I think in the lead up to Christmas is quite
She'd be very busy, I think. And these suggestions are suggestions that have come from the research that she's been doing, the kind of mingling with the community that she's been doing over the last month or so.
Yeah, over 6 months. Yeah.
6 months.
So
she's got a lot of suggestions.
Yeah, so we've got hundreds and hundreds of suggestions, and that's from everybody, from children suggesting that you should go and ride your scooter to feel relaxed, to older members of the community perhaps suggesting to knit something, and they might have donated a knitting pattern for you to have a go at, which slightly terrifies me. I don't think I'd find that very relaxing.
No, I don't think I'd find that, but it would relax some of them. So you were saying you've still got paint on your hand from where you've been painting this shop. So if we go into it, what would we see?
Okay, you'll go in and it will still look like a shop, so it's still got all the shelving up from the bakery. There's this gorgeous very 70s glass cabinets, which will have little jars and bottles with messages in, but there'll also be artworks from Kettle's Yard itself, so you might go in and spot some of the things that you see in the Kettle's Yard house. And then at the back there's a consultation room where people can book an appointment and go in and speak to Emma Smith, the artist, and she will talk to you about things that perhaps are concerning you that you would like advice on or advice to relax on. And she's been inspired by a project that some academics are doing in this Department of the History of Science, who have discovered these things called the casebooks, which were written in the 16th and 17th century. And these two men used to go around to the villages all around kind of East Midlands and East Anglia, and they had these astrology charts, and you could go to them with any problem. So it could be medical or it could be social. So for example, people might say, I don't know which man to marry, should it be James or should it be John? And they would, at the moment you ask your question, they'd look at the stars and go through all their astrology charts and come up with a solution. And that's kind of what Emma's going to reinterpret and reimagine in her consultation. So she'll have some charts, and then she will go through this book of all the advice that she's collected from the community and give you a prescription, in inverted commas, back of advice that people have given to her.
And this is all free?
It's all absolutely free.
And she's there 27th to 29th of November?
That's right, 12 till 5 at 78 Aikman Street, and it's completely free. And we'll also be doing some other activities in the community room at 82 Aikman Street, a couple of doors down, so you can come and have a go at some of the relaxation things that people have suggested, like yoga or baking or doing some of the word games as well.
So it's what she's doing is calling on history from a long time ago,
yeah,
and with current day. It's very contemporary, isn't it? And in a current shop. So it's a nice mixing of past and present.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the strengths of Cambridge, is that mix of historical and contemporary thoughts. And that's something that Emma's really, really interested in her own artistic practice. And she's all about working with people and listening to people and getting people to come together. So also through her research over the last 6 months, she's got these some exchanges going. So she's invited, perhaps say the Punjabi Cultural Society have invited people from outside of their cultural community to come to their Diwali celebration recently. So it was a great way for people to find out about the Punjabi Cultural Society and about Diwali. And also, for example, the King's Hedges Gardening Group were looking for new members. So they wrote an open letter, which Emma delivered to somebody else in the community. And they went along and helped out on their allotments and at King's Hedges Garden Group as well.
She's been busy.
She's been so busy.
But what I like about it is that it is accessible, because sometimes you hear about art installations and, you know, they're sort of a nice idea, but they're not particularly accessible. They're a bit, you know, up there in the ether somewhere. But this one isn't. You can literally go in and partake of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's for everyone, and it's made by people in Cambridge. So it's all of their ideas, and it's just that Emma's kind of brought it all together. But it's all their advice. You're not going to see anything too weird. You're not going to feel uncomfortable. It's all about feeling relaxed, and that's for everybody. We all want to feel relaxed.
We do, we do. Well, well done, Emma. And this is all part of this open house project. What other things have you got lined up as part of that?
So open house is a 3-year project, and Emma's been the first artist in residence. So next year we'll be selecting somebody else. And Emma was selected at a public meeting, which happened in last January. So we'll be replicating that, and there'll be another public vote coming up in the new year. So watch this space. And if you want to find out more about it, visit the Kettle's Yard website, or you can follow us on Twitter at Kettle's Yard, or there's an open house Twitter feed, which is at Open House Cam. And that will give you all the information about where you can find out about future things. But it's a fantastic project, and I've just loved getting involved and getting to know our local community and all the amazing things that have happened in our area. I mean, there's so many groups, so many things for people to do.
Cambridge is like that, isn't it? There's so much going on.
So busy.
Oh, you must come back and tell us more about all these events that are happening over the 3 years. Your website's kettlesyard.co.uk.
That's right.
When will Kettle's Yard itself be open again?
So we're, as I said, we're in the middle of a big building project at the moment, but we'll be reopening in about 2 years.
2 years? Gosh, that is big, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. But it it'll be amazing when it reopens.
Well, it's pretty amazing before. Yeah. Will you have more space for artwork? Is that the idea?
Yeah, so the galleries will slightly be reconfigured, and it means that we can take in loans from other collections from around the world, so we'll have more amazing art to see. But we can also bring in school groups and have a whole class working together, doing lots of making in our new education studios, and there's all sorts of places for to have coffee, of course, as we mentioned, but also to have seminars and things like that. So it will be even more thriving.
No joke about the coffee house, but the thing about having a cafe there is that people that spend longer in a gallery, I presume, and feel more identified with it. You know, they might just go for a coffee and roam around.
Yeah, it's just about sort of taking some time, really. I mean, when Jim and Helen opened Kettle's Yard to the public when they lived there, Jim invited people to stay behind for tea and toast, and that was just as much a part of the experience, was to talk about the art that you were looking at and having that conversation. And as we all know in this country, tea is a great conduit for conversation. I don't know, Jim wasn't the best cook though. He used to burn the toast quite regularly, so I don't think we'll be having burnt toast in the cafe. I hope not anyway. But
oh no, that's really nice. So you're building on all that tradition and
absolutely
history.
Yeah.
Oh well, it sounds fantastic. Just to run through it again, it's the 27th to the 29th of November, so it's a week today
we'll be open.
A week today, so Friday through till Sunday, 12 till 5.
That's right.
It's free of charge. You can just wander in.
Yep.
Just wander in and get some advice, get your life sorted.
Yep.
Free. Oh, well, thank you, Karen, ever so much for coming in. Good luck with it all. And as I say, do come back and tell us more.
Thank you.
Maybe when you appoint your next artist in residence.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Lee.
Connecting our city. Cambridge 105. Now on DAB Digital Radio.